Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. I gave a talk at a Unitarian church last week about fake news. The audience was terrific, curious and challenging and engaged. But I found myself talking as much about thinking, how to think critically in our polarized political environment, as about how to spot BS masquerading as fact. And a new book goes right to the heart of this idea. Thinking, Baylor University's Alan Jacobs says, is as much art as science. And his new book delves into the ways we can develop and exercise critical thinking skills. As Alan joins us, I want to hear from you on this. Do you find yourself unable to listen closely and respond with a cogent argument or cogent discussion when you're in the midst of a challenging conversation? What do you want to know about how to think in a polarized environment? Now, I'm asking this because I hear from a lot of people on specific issues like climate change. Well, somebody challenges my thoughts and I'm not quite sure how to listen as closely as I should to the other person's ideas and then respond in a cogent way. So if you find yourself in that situation, I'd like to hear about this. I think Alan Jacobs would have some advice on that. But what do you also want to know about thinking intelligently and critically in a very polarized political environment, as he says, in a world at odds? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Alan Jacobs teaches at Baylor University. The new book is titled How to Think, and he joins us from Waco, Texas. Alan, welcome. Much needed book in a difficult time, so it's really good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Carrie.
Your argument that good thinking doesn't have to be emotionless and sterile, I think, is a powerful one, because I think we've been taken in by this belief that deep conviction, you know, even passion, means somehow that you aren't thinking something through very clearly. And your argument about that resonates with me. Build it out a little bit, if you would.
Well, I think you could start by using an example that you just used, the controversy over climate change. I don't think it would be healthy to be completely emotionless and passionless in thinking about the future of our planet. If you think about all the damage that we could conceivably do, given human power, and you think about that damage extending beyond human beings to the whole ecosystem, that's something that ought to arouse some emotion. We ought to care. And what we should do then is channel that caring in a positive way, rather than just letting ourselves be consumed by anger at people who don't think the way we do about how we should deal with these problems. Instead, try to channel that passion and use it. But it ought to be there. And if it's not there, I think something's wrong.
And I think that's part of the art that you talk about of critical thinking as much as it is about the science. But I think you've said we're invested in the idea of the science of this and not enough in the art. So what does that mean?
Well, first of all, I want to say that there's been tremendous progress made in the last 20 years in the science of thinking, cognitive psychology, understanding how that works. But I think on a day-to-day basis, we rarely have the opportunity to step back from whatever it is that we're engaged in, whoever it is we're talking with, be completely disconnected from them, and then take all the time that we need in order to weigh up things on both sides and all of that. What we need are what some of those cognitive scientists call heuristics, that is, little shortcuts. And I think that sometimes some of the most important shortcuts that we can have involve making sure that we are interacting with the most thoughtful and constructive people possible, whether they're on our side or not on our side. And there's not a science by which you can say this person is 97% constructive, whereas this other person is only 82% constructive. You really do have to have a kind of a feel for people. You have to be able to listen to them, pay close attention to how they engage with other people, not not just how they treat you, but how they treat others, and start getting a sense, I think this is somebody that I can trust, whereas this other person maybe is not quite so trustworthy. And those are rational assessments, but they're not mathematical.
Yeah, Alan, this is the most important part of your book for me, so I'm going to come back to it and delve in, but I want to grab a call here from Krissa in Northfield. Hi, Krissa. Thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Well, my family really likes to have political discussions a lot of times at dinner. Uh-huh. And my husband and I have some differing viewpoints specifically on gun control and then just the importance of climate change. And we've had a really hard time trying to keep those discussions productive, and they tend to get really heated. And we've tried a variety of different tactics to, you know, to make them more productive, and we've never really succeeded. And so it's something that comes up a lot in my family.
Okay. So this is something, again, Alan, I'm kind of zeroing in on what you write about. Having thought this through well yourself, having a lot of conviction around it, but then being able to have that discussion with someone of a different view. So advice for Krissa, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most helpful things here is something I learned from my friend Robin Sloan, who is a novelist. He didn't come up with this himself, but he went to a debate that was being held in San Francisco. And the way that the debate began was that you have two people who hold different views on a topic, and person A is told, I want you to articulate person B's position.
Ah.
You try to sum it up as best you can, and then person B will listen to you. And when he or she gets to the point of thinking that you've got it right, we'll give you the thumbs up. And then they flip the script, and then person B has to do that for person A. So the debate could not happen until each side had represented the other side in a way that that other side thought was fair.
That's excellent.
And I think that's an incredibly useful exercise. So when you find yourself getting to that point where the conversation isn't productive anymore, then I would suggest taking on that discipline and say, okay, the lady who just called in, she says, here's what I understand, my beloved husband, here's what I understand you to believe. And then once she's got it right, then he has to do that for her. I think it would be interesting to see where the conversation would go if you started with that.
I think you're practicing this on social media, and you write a lot about what social media doesn't give us as far as depth and serious critical thinking, but that it can also be a pretty valuable tool. But you created this private Twitter group, and it is not mm-hmm. just a bunch of people who are like-minded to you. I think you say they are like-hearted. I love that. I'm going to practice that. So explain how it works.
Yeah. So I have a little private Twitter world. I use my public Twitter account almost exclusively for sharing links because I think it just gets so heated over there. It's very hard to have constructive conversations. But on my little private account, I've got about 100 people, and almost all of them are people that I know in real life, though some of them I met actually on Twitter. I happen to be a Christian. Some of them are Christians. Some of them are Jews. Some of them are atheists. Some of them are right wing. Some of them are left wing. They're kind of all over the place. Some are scientists. Some are humanists. Some are homemakers. There's just a whole range of people. But I love all of these people because they just have generous dispositions. They have a generous heart. And if I say something that they don't agree with, instead of writing me a profane letter like the people I just heard that you get sometimes, instead of that, they'll say, well, why do you think that? Or that doesn't sound right to me. Or, but what about this? And because I know that they're interacting in good faith, I can actually let them challenge me. And sometimes I'll say something and someone will challenge me on it, and I'll talk with them about it, and I'll realize, you know, I wasn't right about that. I got that wrong, at least in part. But I can only do that because I trust them, and I know that they mean well, and they want to get it right. They're not just fighting for their tribe. And so if you can find people like that, and they're not easy to find, you know, then that's a treasure. That's a treasure to you. Anybody who will challenge you but will do it because they want to get it right, not because they're trying to win political battles or social battles, that's huge.
And Alan, also super valuable for you, because then you must articulate what you think, maybe in two or three different ways, if you want to not necessarily win the argument, but show them fully why you believe what you believe. So this forces you to do that, too.
It does. It does. And then I have to say, well, do I actually have good reasons for thinking this, reasons that would be convincing to this person? And if not, why not? Where is our point of disagreement? But I also think sometimes I just find out what I sound like. You know, I mean, sometimes you can find yourself in an echo chamber and with people who agree with your basic views on things, and you just forget what you sound like to people who don't agree. You know, and I'll say something, and somebody will say, "What? That doesn't make sense because of this or that." And I'll go, "Oh gosh, I did sound like an idiot there, didn't I?" And that's really useful, I think.
Alan Jacobs is with us if you've just gotten in on the conversation. You'll find it on the podcast if you've missed part of it. His new book is called How to Think, and it's this wonderful, it's a slim little book packed full of great ideas and discussion about how to think critically in a world of knee-jerk reaction on social media, but also trying to like win the argument hands down. I don't want to even hear what you have to say after this, and how to check in on yourself about how well you're thinking critically, but also then how to hear the other person's ideas, and then how to find a group of people who are, as he says, like-hearted, not like-minded. You don't want to live in an echo chamber. That's not very interesting. So your questions and your thoughts about that, and whether you kind of get mired in the adversarial piece of this when you're trying to have a discussion about things that really matter to you with somebody who disagrees. 651-227-6000 to join us. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR to Jean in Bemidji. Jean, what do you want to know from Alan on this?
Well, I would like a little discussion on the art of listening and asking for a repeat of the narrative given by the speaker so that you can really understand the conversation. There's an art to communication. You don't always have to speak, but you must listen and watch body language to know where the other person is really coming from.
Okay. So the art of truly engaged listening, Alan. I get asked about this a lot, too. What do you say about it?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great – I mean, all of that is really important. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why social media tend to lead us astray so often, is that if we can't read the body language, we can't read the tone of voice, all we have is the words, then we can easily get it wrong. And we all know that on social media you make a joke and then people who don't know you think that you're being serious, you know, because they didn't hear the tone of voice, because the tone of voice isn't there. So we want to be careful about making our judgments when we have limited information, which we always do when we're not physically personally present to one another. So that's an important point. But secondly, I think this is exactly right. You cannot do that exercise that I learned from Robin Sloan without really, really listening. And you have to listen, try to present that person's point of view. They're going to tell you you got something wrong, and you have to listen to that now, and you have to continue to try to correct. But that, you know, listening like that, listening really carefully, it puts you in a position of vulnerability, because the more closely you listen, the more it becomes possible that you could change your mind. And you might not want to change your mind. You might be thinking about the costs of changing your mind. Not necessarily, you know, 100%, but changing it to some degree. And so there's a part of us that doesn't want to listen, because when we do listen, we run the risk of making our lives more complicated. And who needs that, right? Our lives are complicated enough already.
That's a really good point that you just made about the risks of being open-minded, or at least open in the moment to changing your mind. You might have invested, as you've noted, a lot in holding this view. I also hear from people who you're part of a tribe, and you're going to be shamed by the rest of your own tribe if you're really seen as having an open mind and a willingness to change your view.
Right. And I think, to me, this is maybe since I finished writing the book and I've talked to more and more people about it, this is probably the element of it that's come right to the top for me more often than anything else, is this phenomenon that C.S. Lewis calls the inner ring, where if you want to belong to the inner ring, you have to say the right things, you have to have the right opinions, and those inner rings can be ruthless in purging people who say something wrong, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of social media really functions that way. Freddie DeBoer is a professor and blogger who wrote a piece on Medium a few months ago called Everybody's a Cop. And that's sort of the way he feels like the world of social media has become, one where everybody's a cop. Everybody is watching you, and you know they're gonna bring you under arrest, you know, if you say the wrong thing. And that's something that you can find across the political and social spectrum, is people who are cops, people who are all about the inner rings. But then there are genuine communities. And in a genuine community where people care about one another, there's more room for disagreement. You know, you're not going to get thrown out of that little world by saying, you know, I'm not sure this is right. And in fact, that's one of the ways you can tell whether a community is really a community or whether it's an inner ring. How tolerant is it of questions, of people who are confused, of people who are not sure, of people who have doubts? And, you know, you can, when you come across people like that, you can, as I think it was Ross Douth that said in the New York Times, you can treat them as deplorables or you can treat them as persuadables.
Yeah.
And if you think of them as persuadables, you know, then you have an investment. You make that investment in engaging with them, even at the risk of having your own mind changed a little bit.
The book is called How to Think. What do you want to know for our conversation about how to think in this polarized environment that we're in, and then how to articulate what you think, but also how to listen to someone else's views and then have that persuadable, in-depth, you know, conversation where you hold your convictions, but you're also open to the ideas of someone else. Yes, that's where we are. We actually need to be retrained to do this. And I wonder if you've mastered this, if you've been in the middle of this at your family dinner table. How does this work for you? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where a listener says, can we both acknowledge our position could be wrong? Good, let's talk. That's a good place to start, I would think, Alan. What do you think of that?
Right. Yeah. You know, and I think it's hard, right? Because there are certain things about which I can say I might be wrong, but I don't really believe it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that some convictions are so heartfelt, you know, that I can say, well, I may be wrong, you know, but you don't really, really mean it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things, like, for instance, here's one way that I like to think about that, right? I mean, no, there aren't very many people who genuinely want to see people die from lack of health care.
Right.
There aren't very many people who, like, take pleasure in that, right?
Right.
And so now if they are, then if they do take pleasure in it, then they really are deplorable. And, you know, and I don't think a conversation with such a person would be useful. But for most people, it's a question, okay, well, what kind of health care system is actually most effective in getting the best health care to the widest number of people? And so you don't have to say, well, I think people should have health care, but I may be wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be, you know,
yeah,
no, of course I'm not wrong.
Yeah, right.
But I can say maybe the current system is one in which this is one of the things I say. Maybe the current system is one in which people like me benefit.
Yeah.
I get excellent health care and I don't have a problem getting it. But I have members of my family back in rural Alabama, you know, for whom getting decent health care is literally impossible. So let's talk about that, right? We don't want people to die. How can we best prevent it? That way, we can be open about the means While nevertheless not ever having to say, maybe it's better if those people die. You know, you don't have to say that, right? You don't have to say, I could be wrong that they should get good health care. No,
gotcha.
Just talk about the means.
Paul in Minneapolis called in earlier and he said, I view myself as a critical thinker, but I've noticed that lately I've become lazy and I'm ashamed to say that I've posted things on Facebook that I haven't researched and I've been called out as fake news. And then Paul says, I'm ashamed. And Alan, you heard me say this, that I gave a speech to a group last week, and I had finished your book, and I ended up talking as much about fake news and how to understand, mm-hmm. you know, where this information is coming in. But I also really urge the group to think clearly and challengingly to themselves about mm-hmm. just what it is that they're trying to that they're using links and they're using arguments to say about right. themselves and their own right. thinking. And your right. book was super helpful for that. Add anything well, to that if you'd like.
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to say, you know, Paul is my hero, right? I mean, Paul said, I mean, he's ashamed. He's embarrassed. You know, he got called out. And when he was called out on social media, he acknowledged, at least to himself, you know, I didn't do that right. I did share something without following up on it. I need to do better. I mean, how many people do that? You know, we're in an environment where so many people just double down on whatever it is that you know they start with. And here's the thing, right? If somebody like Paul, if you start doing that, if you post something and somebody says, you know, that is fake news. If you look at this story, you'll see that that's actually not true. And then Paul were to say, my bad. I shouldn't have posted that. I should have looked first. I mean, first of all, look at what you're signaling to the people in your Facebook circle. You're saying, you know what, I care about getting it right. And when I get it wrong, I'm going to apologize. And you're setting such a good example for other people when you do that.
Good point.
And I think that is something that in itself can build a network of trust, right? You're showing that you're a trustworthy person. And then maybe somebody else will follow that example later on. Maybe they won't, but you're giving them the chance to. So I think we need more people like Paul.
I also want to say, for anyone who is confused about fake news, and I talked about this, it's not fake news is not news you disagree with. It's right. verifiably incorrect and afactual. And I think there's some confusion around
exactly.
that, but that's actually a different conversation. So
exactly.
To the phones here to Clara in St. Paul. Hi, Clara. What are you thinking about?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I love the conversation this morning, and it reminded me of our former representative who has passed on, Jim Oberstar, and something that he said a long time ago. He was talking toward the end of his Congress career, and he said, when in the early days of being a United States congressman, he and his fellow Congress people from the other side of the aisle would ride out to Washington in a car, and they would have to discuss stuff. He said, this is really where we discuss everything. But he said now, at the later years, he said, we're not talking to each other. We fly out, we fly back. So I thought that I never forgot that, because it spoke to me about conversations and about the respect.
It's good.
Excuse me, the respect that you're talking about.
It's kind of a captive audience right in that car for 2 days. Call here from PK in Minneapolis. Sounds like you've practiced some of this. What works for you?
I use kind of a simple theory of inquiry by John Dewey, where we concentrate on describing the problem well before we're going to get to the solution.
That's good.
And just to point out that when you're talking about a problematic situation, or you're talking about, you know, what's in front of you, your position is included in that, and everyone else's is too. If you leave people out, you don't have an accurate description of the situation.
That's really good. Right. What do you think, Alan?
Oh, yeah, I think that's excellent. And that's really, in some ways, what that exercise of describing one another's views are. You really can't do that without describing the larger situation as well. And so, yeah, I think that's terrific. If we can just, on any particular issue, if we can say, come to some sort of agreement about what is actually at stake, that is already a step. And if I could say quickly in relation to the previous caller, some years ago, Sam Brownback, who was a very conservative senator from Kansas,
the governor. Right.
Yeah, that's right. But at this time, he was the senator, and he was in a Senate prayer and Bible study group with Hillary Clinton, and so when his fellow Republicans would say, you know, when they would say the worst possible things about her, Brownback would have to say, you know, I disagree with her about all sorts of things. He said, but I've read the Bible with her and I've prayed with her and I know her heart, you know, and she really does believe in the things that I believe in. And I just can't talk about her the way that you guys talk about her, you know. And it was a very interesting thing because they're way, you know, miles and miles apart. And I wonder if they would have that same level of charity towards one another now that they no longer have a regular time where they get together. Because if you're just not, you know, in the presence of somebody who's very different than you, you really can end up dehumanizing them. And because they're humanized for you at one point doesn't mean it will always stay that way. So we really do need those kinds of networks where we're having to acknowledge the humanity of people who disagree with us. Because after all, the fact that we are all humans, that's why we live in the same world, and we need to have debates about how to live well in it.
You know, a few minutes ago, you were talking about posting something on social media and then getting into a discussion, then realizing how you sound to yourself. And I was thinking that some of our cynicism, I think, about politics right now is that we don't believe that our leaders actually check in on their own arguments, that they're challenging as they can be to themselves. I think if we saw more of that, and maybe the fear is, well, again, you're turning away from the tribe and the tribe is going to get payback on that. But I'd like to see our political leaders doing more of that. What do you think?
I would love it, but I think they have handlers now, right? And they've always had handlers, of course, but the sort of the science of political handling now is so far advanced. I mean, you know this when you watch a politician show up on, you know, one of the Sunday morning talk shows or on an NPR station or on Morning Edition or whatever, and somebody asks them a question. You know, within 10 seconds, they will have veered off from the question to their talking points.
Oh,
right?
It's infuriating.
I mean, every opportunity to be, you know, that's how they're trained to see it, as an opportunity to get out the message that you want to get out. And so they can't really be surprised by a question because they're not really going to answer the question. They're going to get off of it as quickly as they can. And so there is an environment in which politicians are trained not to think. Thinking is the worst thing you could do in a situation like that because that'll get you off message.
Oh,
similarly,
it's ridiculous, Alan. I mean, come on. Yeah, what were we going to say?
But well, it works on journalists as well, right? I have friend who is a journalist at one point was in New York, writing for a New York paper. And he would be invited to come on radio or television talk shows from time to time. And the idea was that, okay, well, you're here to represent this particular political point of view. And if he were to go on there and somebody – he's conservative. So if somebody were to articulate a more liberal position and he were to say, you know, that's a good point. I think you're right. Well, he would never be invited back, right? Because then he wouldn't be representing that point of view. And so therefore, once again, he's expected to stay on message just the way the politicians are expected to stay on message. So we have a kind of a public culture in which thinking is pretty – strictly discouraged, and that kind of makes me weep.
Yeah, I mean, there's me too. There's rewards for that, but that's I think you're talking about cable, right? A call here from Portia in Minneapolis, and Portia, I'm tight on time, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I really appreciate this discussion.
Thank you
for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor at the U, and I teach in the health coaching program, and we really teach our students how to show up and listen. And I want to just emphasize that and put out a couple kind of pro tips, because I feel like what you said earlier about listening puts us in a vulnerable position because it might change our mind.
Right.
Like, how wonderful is that? And you know, we teach our students to really show up with a lot of curiosity. And as someone, you know, like say we're sitting around the holidays listening to a relative go on and on about something that we disagree with, you can just keep reflecting back what you're hearing. So I'm hearing you say this. Oh, how curious. You know, how did you come to believe that? Oh, so this is what you believe. And you, and by reflecting that back with curiosity, it allows that person to actually hear themselves, and they might actually start changing how they see themselves through that. So it actually brings you closer together versus like digging your heels into, you know, your belief system that you think is right, which is separating.
Does that make sense to you, Alan?
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really terrific. That's sort of an example of what I'm talking about in my little, you know, private Twitter world, where I will realize what I sound like. And that's a way to generate that in a non-threatening way, right? Because as soon as people feel threatened, then they either clam up or they get confrontational. So if you can train your students to have that kind of generous, outgoing, listening posture, that can be disarming. And then that really, in a way, you're giving a gift to that other person, the gift of understanding how they sound and how they're thinking, and that can be something that they can benefit from too.
I'm going to recommend the Thinking Person's Checklist at the end of the book to everyone who's interested in this, but I want to point out number four, remember, you don't have to respond to what everyone else is responding to in order to signal your virtue and right-mindedness. Boy, you've summed up the social media scene exactly right there.
Yeah. And that's, I think sometimes, you know, just sit back for a few minutes. Somebody else will say that thing that you wanted to say. And one of the things that can happen is that when they say it, you can think, oh, I am so glad I didn't say that. You know,
right.
Just giving yourself a little bit of time, you realize that wouldn't have been a constructive contribution at all.
Alan, this has been such a pleasure. I hope you'll come back when you have some free time, another time. More to talk about on my end. I hope on yours, too.
I would be delighted to do so,
right.
Carrie. Thanks for having me on.
Alan Jacobs' book is called How to Think, A Survival Guide for a World at Odds. You can read more about it at the thread, nprnews.org/thread. You can continue the conversation on Twitter, @CarrieNPR.